octopi can change color. Well, most people, I think, assume that they do this for camouflage. That would be a reasonable assumption. They don't do it for camouflage. Let's talk about octopi for just a moment. First of all, they're mollusks. They divided from our evolutionary line 700 million years ago. They're related to escargot. They have no backbone, for crying out loud. They're not even vertebrates. But what is always said in biology classes about octopi is that they're a wonderful example of parallel evolution because their optical system is very much like a mammalian optical system. Well, why is this? Well, it's because they evolved in an environment, the reef environment, that is an environment all as dense with signals as a rainforest is. And an octopus is soft-bodied. It can not only change color, but it can also change its surface from smooth and rubbery to bumpy, pimply, rugose, ribbed, so forth and so on. And also, because it is soft-bodied and in an aqueous environment, it can fold and unfold and reveal and conceal parts of its body very, very quickly. Well, all of these behaviors and physiological characteristics go together to make the octopus an excellent visual communicator. And the color changes, the blushes, traveling dots and bars that these creatures manifest, and the squids do it too, are language. And if you're interested in this, there's a wonderful book by a guy named Monahan called Communication and Non-Communication Among the Cephalopoidea. And he goes as far as creating a grammar for this stuff. Well, so then, in a way, you know, if you pull back from the mundane assumptions about this, what's happening is the octopus wears its mind on its skin. It is dressed in its mental state. One octopus encountering another can tell its mood, how recently it's eaten, how recently it's had sex, whether it's ovulating, all by looking. And so the only way an octopus can have a private thought is by squirting ink into the water and then hiding inside it. This is essentially, it's correction fluid for misspoken octopi, you see. So in a sense, this is what I think we are being beckoned toward, that we want to clothe ourselves in language. We do it to a degree in a funny way. I mean, if you want to think about virtual reality, this is a virtual reality. All this stuff, these fixtures, the architecture, the infrastructure, the road, these are ideas. It was an idea, and it has then been summoned into matter by the allotment of funds, the spending of money, the hiring of craftsmen, so forth and so on. Our whole civilization is an excreted set of interlocking ideas,
agreements.
We're like coral animals. And we, somewhere, you know, there's this naked, pulpy creature, but, you know, clothed in denim, clothed in a harder shell produced by Mercedes or Chevrolet, moving around inside a larger environment produced by the state of Colorado, and so forth and so on. So I think octopi offer an excellent metaphoric example of what naked-mindedness would be. And some of these octopi, as I said, they evolved in the coastal reef domain. But that's a very competitive domain. Everybody in the ocean wants to be there because that's where the sunlight and the food is. So if you're smart, you'll try and evolve into a more hostile niche. And some of these octopi have become what are called benthic or abyssal. It means they exist in the parts of the ocean where light never reaches. Yes. And they have retained this communication ability by switching over to interiorly generated phosphorescence. So there are species of octopi which actually are studded with organs that have the equivalent of eyelids over them, but they're flasher lights. So when you descend into the benthic depths of the ocean, you enter a domain where all one octopus ever sees of another octopus is its linguistic productivity, because that's interior generated light that can be seen. And I think, you know, if you want to set the compass of virtual reality towards something worth writing home about, then producing an octopus environment so that we could experience this kind of thing would be a kind of proto-telepathic playpen of some sort. Yeah.
I guess I'm skeptical enough to occupy other words for these colors that aren't really indicative of what they're thinking of, but the word aliveness that you do.
So you think that subterfuge enters here too?
Yeah, that wasn't my real question. My real question is, last night when you were discussing the role of psychedelics in human evolution, you were going by a strictly Darwinian theory.
Right.
I assume since you're associated with Rupert Sheldrake in various endeavors that you've entertained other theories. And if so, have you considered the possibility that psychedelics may influence evolution, the evolution of humankind in a very direct way? In other words, have a direct effect upon the DNA so that, you know, this selection
you want me to...
It's a central dogma of biology that information can get out of the DNA but can't get back in directly. In other words, it can only be selected for over a period of generations. Have you ever played around with the theory that...
Yeah, well, you raise a lot of issues. First of all, since the discovery of retroviruses, of which the HIV virus is one, we now know that it is not always information transcripted from DNA to RNA to protein. The retroviruses transcript from RNA to DNA. So the central dogma, which is that the genome is not being altered by the environment, is sort of shaky at this point. You bring up a very interesting point, which has never, to my mind, been really thrashed out in orthodox science, which is, if you had a bunch of these psychedelic molecules and we could raise them up to the size of loaves of bread or something like that, what you would notice about them is they're all what are called by chemists planar, meaning they tend to be flat. They're not lumpy. They're flat. Well, if you look at DMT or harmine, harmine is built off a pentexyl group and with two benzene rings off of it. It is the perfect size to slip in between two nucleotides in DNA. It can actually bond into the DNA there. Now, many drugs do this. These drugs are called dimers. The usual problem with a dimer that will intercalate, this is the other term, intercalate means slide between the rungs of the DNA, is it usually deforms the DNA. It like passes a bulge along it, and then transcription is difficult. But these indole hallucinogens can dimer with DNA without disrupting its structural integrity. This is why I believe that this is the source of the visions. That, and, you know, orthodox biologists just roll their eyes at this idea and say, well, now you've made a very common error here. You've confused genetic information with information. Don't you understand that genetic information is just a sequence of codons coding for protein? And you know, that has no relationship to your memory of Aunt Minnie's face. However, by being so unyielding on that point, they create a huge problem for their brothers and sisters across the hall who are trying to understand memory. Because the molecular theory of memory is a nightmare. Here's the problem. Every molecule in your body is changed every 5 to 7 years, depending on who you talk to, except neurons. The nerves are generally the nerves you're born with or the nerves you die with. But it's an absolute no-no to suggest that memory is lodged in the neurons. Well, but if Aunt Minnie died 45 years ago, and you can still remember the dear woman's face when she used to walk you in the park, then every molecule of your body has been swapped out 5 times since she quit the plane. How can you have this memory of Aunt Minnie? Well, they don't say, actually. They just throw up their hands. Now, to the people who say DNA can't store any kind of information other than codon sequences for proteins, they have to explain why then 90% of the genome seems devoted to junk sequencing that does not produce protein, that does in fact not do anything that anybody knows about. It seems to me that we might as well just take the path of least resistance and say, if the neurons are the only part of the body that persists throughout life, if the memories persist throughout life, then you've got 2 choices. Either the memories are in the neurons, or the memories were never stored in the body in the first place. And if you'd believe that, well, then the obligation to explain just where they were stored is hard upon you, and the mechanism for retrieving them. So I think molecular biology, by being so reductionist, has made certain problems in neurophysiology and higher cortical functioning almost insoluble. You know, for years and years, it was held that this was another one of these central dogmas of biology. It was held that information could move from the nucleus of the neuron to the synapse, but that there was no transport mechanism for moving any molecular species from the synapse back to the nucleus. So consequently, they said learning cannot take place in the nucleus of the neuron, because the materials for learning, which would be present in the synapse, modifications through experience, there's no transport system. And this was dogma until 10 years ago. Well, then they discovered what's called axioplasmic transport, and they, by putting labeled compounds in the synapse, they were able to locate these labeled compounds later, complexed with nuclear material in the neuron, proving to the most diehard materialist that synaptic material was in fact moving backward to the neuron. So I think that, you know, there's much that isn't understood about how all this works. Something worth pointing out, you know, science seeks closure and explanatory closure. My brother one time made a little aphorism, which I think says it all on this subject. He said to me once, actually on a mushroom trip, he said, "Have you ever noticed how as the sphere of understanding grows ever larger, necessarily the surface area of ignorance gets ever bigger?" Seems perfectly clear. You know, a simple-minded way of saying that is the bigger you build the bonfire, the more darkness you will reveal. Yeah.
And also, any progress really comes from outside the context of the paradigm that's having the experience. I mean, it really, to my knowledge, almost everything that's really been advanced in any in science or philosophy. It's really something that's come from outside the context of the paradigm.
Yes, well, some of you have probably read Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, where he shows, you know, that it's never the way they tell it afterwards. The aftertelling is always about the primary insight, the careful experiment, the gathering of data, the correlation. Actually, it doesn't work like that at all. It's entirely psychic, piecemeal, ruled by synchronicity. One of the most interesting things, I'll tell this story and then we can go to lunch, because I think, you know, science has great pretensions about itself. I mean, it basically regards itself as a meta-theory. It regards itself as capable of passing judgment on all other theories. They are supposed to submit themselves to science to be told whether they're real or not. Yeah, like a religion. Well, how many people know modern science was founded by René Descartes in the early 17th century. What were the circumstances under which Descartes founded modern science? René Descartes was a 19-year-old basically ne'er-do-well, and he decided that he would go wenching and soldiering across Europe, which was a thing that young men of certain class did at that time. And so he joined a Habsburg army that was laying siege to Prague in the summer of 1619, and after they had taken care of the problem there in Prague, this Habsburg army began to retreat across southern Germany. And on the evening of, now there's a lot of arm wrestling about this, but let's just say the 17th of August, 1619, this army made camp near the little town of Ulm in southern Germany, which, synchronicity freaks, pay attention, Ulm will later be the birthplace of Albert Einstein. Worth noting. But that night, Descartes, in the barracks, had a dream. And an angel appeared to him. And the angel said, the conquest of nature is to be achieved through number and measurement. And he was thunderstruck. He took that angelic revelation and turned it into modern science. Modern science was founded by an angel. You know, they don't tell you this at MIT. It's astonishing how things which claim roots in rationalism are actually among some of the most irrational productions in the historical continuum. It appears that our development, our history, our histories have always been created at the promptings of invisible voices. I mean, Socrates, who is at the very center of what's called thinking and by Western civilization, Socrates had a demon, D-E-A-M-O-N. It was a little voice. It was his crap detector. It told him the difference between profound philosophical thinking and bullpucky. So the edifice of Western thinking built on Platonism owes its debt to an invisible agency speaking from hyperspace. So does modern science a la Descartes. How much more of this? I mean, we don't care if artists talk to angels, because our definition of them is that they're screwballs. But to believe that an enterprise like modern science has to trace its way back to the same ecstatic roots is, I think, very suggestive that the world is stranger than we can suppose, and that we need to open these channels of communication to these invisible worlds. Probably the next great paradigm shift will be enunciated by a mushroom, an angel, an elf, an alien, what have you. Yeah.
So the DMT trip,
Repetition. Yeah. The first few times I did it, I couldn't get any grip at all on it. And by talking a lot and trying to describe it, you slowly, slowly build up a map. So, about the Logos. The Logos is this phenomenon that was sort of the centerpiece of Greco-Hellenic spirituality. And what it is it's a voice in the head that people strove to attain for 1,000 years. This was the sine qua non of intellectual accomplishment in the Greco-Roman world. And the Logos told you the right way to live. And this is sort of what you get with psilocybin. You get a voice that can confound you with the depth and brilliance of its answers. And one of the great, you know, one of the puzzles of trying to understand Greco-Hellenic spirituality is, what were they talking about? And if this ever was a general phenomenon, then what happened to it? Why do we not experience this? This is not well understood. I mean, the rational scholars who have created our vision of Greece basically just don't even want to talk about this. They would rather gloss over it. You know, one of the things that sort of relates to all this is, I think human beings are a lot more malleable than we tend to imagine. In other words, we imagine that people in the distant past or in Greece or somewhere were just like us, except they were living in a different time and place. There's no way to find out, of course, because they're all dead. But there are certain episodes in the evolution of Western culture that suggest that people may be much more plastic than we ordinarily suppose. First example would be, how can it be that in the middle 1500s, perspective was discovered? I mean, how do you discover perspective? This is very hard, I think, for modern people to understand, because it's a given for us. I mean, we see in perspective. We accept it as a quality of the world rather than a cultural artifact put in place at a certain moment. But in fact, during the Renaissance, only the most inspired people could paint in perspective on the natch. Most people, they had complex devices called perspectographs that would project over the scene a receding grid, and then people would essentially fill in the lines. Now, another example of this kind of thing that's not so well known, but that is an example that Marshall McLuhan makes a lot of, is St. Augustine, the great father of the Christian church. He had a reputation for being a very holy man, and the accounts of his contemporaries say that the way people would satisfy themselves that St. Augustine had a pipeline to God is they would bring him scripture, the Bible essentially, and open it in front of him and let him look at it, and then they would close the book and question him about what was there, and he could always tell them. And they were amazed. As far as we can tell, St. Augustine was the only man in Europe who could read silently. Nobody else could do it. It was regarded as a miracle. Now, we all read silently, and there may be a few unfortunate individuals among us who move their lips while they read, but that's the only vestigial trace we have of this previous cultural mode where everyone, to read meant to read aloud. No one could conceive of any other way of doing it. The Logos seems to me a kind of similar thing. It was a mental behavior function which, for reasons which are probably complex and unknowable, slipped out of reach. That's why It seems to me these psychedelics are very close to being able to modify our behaviors along these kinds of lines, because there are a number of behavioral and experiential possibilities that we suppress. I mean, I think it's just as an example of how little we know about what's going on. Look at the Gaffen, well, don't look at it, but conceive of the Gaffenberg spot, the G spot. Now, we all know what this is. Clearly, people were looking for it for a long, long time. How come they only discovered it 12 years ago? I mean, if something that major can be overlooked, then it's hard to imagine what might have been overlooked. I mean, that's pretty central into the project of being a human being. And apparently it was unknown until very, very recently. So, yes, the logos was probably what I call the Gaian mind. And that at a certain point in cultural development, people just became so chuckle-headed that the Gaian mind just said, well, the hell with this. And then the voice fell silent. It fell silent right at the around the time of the birth of Christ, right at the time of the of the shift of the zodiacal aeon, you know.
Would you consider maybe giving us a phenomenological run-through like you did with the ayahuasca or the DMT vision, relative to how this, you know, from your experience with people that you've talked to, just how this...
how it works with psilocybin?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, what you have experienced and people you've talked to.
Well... I mean, when I take psilocybin, I take it on an empty stomach. I don't fast or anything like that. I just don't eat for 6 hours. I don't call that fasting. And then I take it in silent darkness. That's number one, very important. The next thing is weigh the dose. You must weigh the dose. Because 5 grams is what you want. And I've had over and over the experience of showing somebody what 5 grams is, and they're appalled. They say, my God, you can't be serious. I mean, I take a fifth that much, a fourth that much. Yeah, well, that's the problem. That's why you don't have elves in the attic and bats in the belfry like I do, you know. And so then you take it, and I take it on an empty stomach, and a lot of people don't like the taste. I don't really understand that. I just chew them up. I sit with them, and I chew them up. And then, huh?
Dried.
None of this mixing in applesauce or any of that malarkey. I mean, what's that about?
Well, I used to think fresh.
Oh, well, fresh, 60 grams.
Okay.
60 grams. Because there's more than a, you know, there's a huge water loss there. And then it takes, people sometimes say it came on within 5 minutes or it came on within 10 minutes. I don't know what that could possibly be about. First of all, it defies pharmacodynamics to imagine that it could come on that fast. For me, it comes on almost always at the 1 hour and 20 minute mark. I think it can come on sooner than that. I think I'm fairly resistant to these things. In the hour, after I take it, I sit, I roll bombers, and I carry out what all good Catholics know as an examination of conscience. This means you think about all the bummers that you're afraid are going to jump out at you as soon as you get loaded. If you will carry out the examination of conscience, you'll be so bored with that by the time the compound actually hits that you usually don't have to pay any dues because you've, you know, faced the fact that you're a jerk 50 times in the preceding hour. So, and then the way I do it is at about the hour and 20-minute mark, and I should say in the time preceding that, you may have to go to the bathroom once. You may... it makes your nose run, which is a funny thing. It also makes you yawn. These are definitely qualities of psilocybin, not related to its psychoactivity. And And I think that it's very good to decide before it hits that once it begins, you will not alter the plan. In other words, you decide ahead of time, I'm going to sit here and do this. Because at about the hour and 15 minute mark, it will begin hitting you with stuff like, you'd really be more comfortable downstairs. Or, you know, it's awfully hot in here. Why don't you get up and adjust the thermostat? All this stuff. You say, no. We're holding the space and sit there. And then it begins to come on. And it comes, the image I have is like a jellyfish or a silk scarf or something like that. It just kind of drifts down and surrounds you. And at that point, I guess I pray. I say to it, you know, I'm completely in your hands. Please don't hurt me. You know, I'm yours. I'm completely committed. I've held nothing back. So don't burn me, please. And then there is a kind of, it's hard to describe, a kind of potential begins to build up. And you say, the rush hasn't begun, but it's, you can almost close your eyes and see millions of little psilocybin molecules elbowing serotonin molecules out of the way and fitting themselves into the receptor site, and the electron spin resonance dynamics is beginning to shift, and the whole thing is about to take off. At that point, I smoke furiously, and that usually is all it takes. And it comes on, and the first rush is really astonishing. I mean, sometimes it's more mind-boggling than others, but I can remember situations where I would just see it coming and say, oh my God, you know, it's 100 miles wide and 10 miles high. Where are you going to run to? You know, it's just, you say, good grief. You know, I guess I'm not going to meet this one sitting up. I think I better lay down. And in about the time it takes to make and execute that decision, then it just hits. And it's like a tidal wave. I mean, I have the feeling when I'm doing it in California that everybody from Vancouver to Tijuana has just crawled under their desk, because you can't imagine this is happening between my ears. You know, it's more like an asteroid must have fallen in the Pacific Ocean and raised some enormous incoming wave. It's what it's sort of like. It's like watching a thermonuclear explosion through 50 feet of crystal clear glass. So, you know, you're perfectly calm. It's not getting at you. But the energy that is being released in your presence is awesome. And then and sometimes in that first pass, you actually, the linguistic machinery is burned out. You've probably seen these scenes where they will test a hydrogen bomb and they set up cameras a quarter mile from ground zero, a half mile, a mile, 2 miles. And then when they actually detonate the bomb, they get the view from the first camera, and then they switch to the second camera as the first camera is blown to bits and vaporized, and they keep pulling back as each successive instrument is destroyed. Well, this is sort of the feeling you have as this thing spreads out toward you. And then it does what it wants to do. It tells you what it wants to tell you. And it's highly unpredictable. I mean, you cannot... People always say you should ask it a question. This seems absurd to me. I mean, I don't know. Once when my life was in turmoil, I did ask a question. I said... I wrote it down ahead of time, and the question was, am I doing the right thing with my life? And then when I got in there and I posed the question, and the answer came back instantly. It was a ripoff from Lyndon Johnson. It said, "What kind of a chicken shit question is that to ask me?" I said, "Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to presume, you know." Said, "Get your act together and then we'll have a conversation, but if that's what you want to talk about, you should have taken MDMA. And it, and then, you know, paralleling what we talked about this morning, and again, I'm just giving you my subjective take on it, it's like I come into a place, it's hard to describe, it's a feeling, and it's the content of the feeling is, now the elves are near, but they won't appear unless I invoke them. And, you know, I wish I could tell you that I chant in Mandayan or something like that, but I don't. I stole a line from an old I Love Lucy program where Ethel is talking to Lucy about UFOs, and Lucy says she talks to the UFOs, and Ethel says, "Well, how can you talk to UFOs?" And Lucy said, "Well, it's simple. I just say, 'Come in, little green men, come in, little green men,' and that's what I do. I say, 'Come in, little green men,' and then there is a, and women, if there are any out there." And then there is a, it's like a marching band. It's like a Nepalese marching band is what it's like. And it comes from a distance. Like there's a place in my vision that's small, a little dancing light and a little faint sound. And the light comes closer and the sound gets louder until finally, you know, they pick me up on their shoulders and with tubas blaring and sackbut and rebeck and all of this stuff. And then they carry me around and talk to me. And the whole thing is shot through with such a weird sense of zaniness, Irishness, Joyce-ishness. I mean, it's almost unbearable. It's so, I don't know, not exactly Disney-esque, because their humor tends to be a little more savage than that. And then that is part of the first wave, and then the rest of the trip unfolds pretty much as you... There's a kind of a pushing and pulling that goes on. You can direct it. Each one of these plants does have a character of its own. Sure. One of the most puzzling things about these plants is that they have characters that seem irreducible. For instance, psilocybin, it is the science fiction drug. In other words, it says, you know, we have been denizens of this planet for 400 million years. Our original home planet is in the M5-83C system. We are connected via hyperspace to all intelligent life forms in the galaxy. It shows you enormous machines in orbit around alien planets. It talks about the end of history and the collectivizing of humanity, and it's this enormous hortatory, salvational, dramatic, science fiction type scenario. Well, then you take ayahuasca, which in molecular terms is just a few nitrogens are moved around. I mean, it's basically the same thing. And you get a completely different message. You feel the energy of the rainforest and the rivers, and it's very feminine. You think about childbirth. You think about the continuity of generations. You think about the mystery of the meat. You think about tantric sexuality. It's all redirected back into the human and natural world in some way. And then, of course, DMT, which I described this morning, which the DMT elves are not... from outer space, or they don't present themselves that way. In fact, one of the odd things about the DMT thing is that you have the feeling that this space that you break into, even though it's large, some people even refer to the dome of DMT. That tells you they really were there. But wherever this huge vaulted space is, you have the feeling, although it's hard to explain how you know this, but you have the feeling that you're way, way, way underground, which fits with the elf motif. You're in the hall of the Mountain King. You're under the hills with the, you know, the little people who retreated under the hills. The character of these things is one of the most puzzling things about them.
And how do you relate all these different species of gremlins to the logos? That's the part.
Well, that's a real question. The logos seems more... It doesn't crack jokes and do quadruple entendre puns and stuff like that. It's more like a wise and loving teacher. These DMT things are, you know, it's a troop of maddened elves, and they are just doing their own thing. And then with ayahuasca, though some people claim they contact an entity, it hasn't been like that for me. It seems to me that on ayahuasca, you become like a camera. You just fly through a visual world. I mean, after a good ayahuasca trip, you just feel like your eyes are bugging out of your head. I mean, it's like buying prints on Madison Avenue, you know, and you've just been looking and looking and looking, and you literally have to give your eyes a rest after an ayahuasca trip. And the ayahuasca visions are more... they seem to cover a broader spectrum. The psilocybin hallucinations tend toward this highly polished, machine-like, insect-like, outer space bit. And the ayahuasca hallucinations are wonderful pastels, laces, layering of colors. And then one of the most interesting things to me about ayahuasca, and I just cannot understand how this works. If I could, I'd be Erte or somebody. And that is that you, in the middle of the ayahuasca trip, you can suggest motifs. You can lead it so that, for instance, you can say to it, Art Deco. And suddenly there will be thousands of candy dishes, cigarette lighters, champagne buckets, automobiles, stained glass windows, doorknobs, silverware, all rolling in black space in front of you, all the perfect exemplification of this aesthetic, the Art Deco aesthetic. And then you can say to it, okay, Italian Baroque. And it just, like that, suddenly altarpieces, Madonnas, martyred saints, in fantastic scroll work and fleur-de-lis. And you can say, well, surprise me. And then you will get a coherent style, like Art Deco, like Italian Baroque, except that it's nobody's ever bothered to realize it on this planet. But it's as coherent. It's like, you know, 20 years ago there was no such thing as Southwest as a style. You know, this weird thing coming out of Santa Fe that I notice has planted its roots deep here as well. The turquoise and beige endlessness of feathers and hammered titanium and all that. Well, that's an aesthetic that has cohered in the last 20 years and come into being. There seem to be an infinite number of these things, as different as the bronzes of the Han Dynasty are to a Dali or a Pollock or a Bosch. And And then you can say to it, going beyond the surprise me challenge, is what I always say to it is, I want to see more of what you are for yourself. And then it's like there's this low organ tone, and it begins to lift the veils, and the temperature in the room drops about 20 degrees. And after about 20 seconds of that, you just say, enough of how you are for yourself. Because you can tell what's happening is it's starting to reveal something so peculiar and so untailored for the human mind or eye that you become afraid. You say, you know, can we go back to dancing mice, Art Deco cigarette lighters, and Baroque altarpieces, please? This is turning into deep water as far as I'm concerned. So, yes.
What happens on higher than, if anything, higher than 5 grams?
Oh, that's a good question. Good question. It requires a small detour into pharmacology.